Accession number 9168, roll number 17.
Mr. Amat, reel 17.
Oh, during the time I was out east, I caught several diseases or illnesses, and the first time was when I was in Iraq, Mosul. I came over feverish and shaking, and the doctor pronounced I got sandfly fever, and very prevalent out there, same as malaria. It only lasts a couple of days, and you get a high fever, and then after piling blankets on your bed and taking a couple of aspirins, you sweat it out and more or less back to normal, although as weak as anything. But you soon get over it. The worst one is malaria, and that's I never had any of that when I was out in Iraq. But when I got to India, and even then it was over 12 months after I'd been in India before I contacted malaria. And it's rather frightening, really, when you get malaria, first of all, because you suddenly comes over all of a sudden, either day or night, and you begin to shake from head to foot. You can't keep still at all. And you a violent headache, and your eyes ache, and your limbs ache as well. A terrible experience, but so prevalent that everybody more or less knows what to do. So what we used to do was you report sick, and the medical orderly would stab a needle in one of your fingers and take a blood smear onto a slide, and then give you a couple of aspirins and ask you to lay down on the bed, and then after a few minutes somebody would come along and put the slide under a microscope, and from that they can decide whether you've got malaria or not, because the germs show up under the microscope. And the orderly came and said that I got malaria, and I was to stop in hospital for a couple of days and get the usual treatment, plenty of blankets on and sweat it out, and aspirins and plenty of water to drink. And after that you sort of convalesce for two or three days, but after a time you get so used to it you don't report sick at all. When you come over like that, everybody sort of knows, and you go straight back to your bungalow and get into bed, and your powers pile blankets on top of you and give you an aspirin and a hot cup of tea, and then in two or three hours you sort of come to again, and you're covered in perspiration, and you go and have a bath, and you more or less got over the bout. But then you feel very weak, and it takes you a couple of days to get over it again. But it's very prevalent out there, and first of all, the authorities never knew what to do to combat it, only take medicine. But the scientists decided, especially the Italians, who had nothing to do with India at the time, but they got malaria out in Italy, and they decided the best way was to treat the bug in its developing stage. That's where the mosquito, the Ephenophele mosquito, lays its eggs on water, so that if they was to contaminate the water, the eggs wouldn't hatch, and that would stop the mosquitoes. And this is what we used to do eventually in India. All the little pools of water left by the monsoon and all the little puddles were all sprayed almost daily with the medical teams to try and combat this illness. And of course, the natives are very prevalent. I think there's millions of Indians die every year, or used to in those days, from malaria. But because it's been more or less eradicated now, they've got to that stage where all of we used to suffer, they don't suffer nowadays.
Was dysentery a problem?
Big one. Oh, another disease that's very prevalent out the east, it still is, I believe, is dysentery. Now, this this is usually born through the food you eat. And even in the old days when I was out there, if you you weren't allowed to buy any fruit from a stall or a native without it was washed in some sort of disinfectant fluid. And each stallholder used to have a bowl of this. I forget the name of it now, but it was a pinkish colour when it was applied to the water, and the fruit was dropped in that and then wiped with a cloth before ever you started to eat it. But this dysentery was it's a terrible disease because you can't keep anything down. Everything passes through your body, and it's a killer, really, because you never seem to be able to get over it. But there wasn't a lot of it in the British Army when I was out there because of the precautions that were taken. They were very strict on all the food that was eaten, and everything was inspected daily by the medical officer, so there wasn't much chance of many people getting dysentery, but the natives used to suffer with it quite a lot, I believe.
Did many of the troops suffer from venereal disease?
Not very many, no. As I say, the regulations in those days was enforced so strictly that you had, especially out east, if you were out east, you had a medical inspection every week, and you had to pray in front of the medical officer, and he examined each man, and anybody he found who'd been infected with any of the venereal diseases like syphilis or gonorrhea was immediately taken away and put in a hospital. And actually, if he hadn't been to one of the recognised brothels and had contacted any spare woman round the camp, and he'd contacted this, he was charged under a certain act of military act. So it was very strictly enforced. So I don't remember many people. I think there was only one I remember in my unit who was had this venereal disease, and he was put in the hospital, and we never saw him anymore after that. I think he was sent home to England. But as I say, the regulations were so strict and so strictly enforced that it was very rarely that anybody got venereal disease.
Can you tell me about the official brothels?
The official what?
Brothels.
Brothels? Oh, yes. When I first went out there, there was a colonel in charge of our units. Rather unusual for a colonel to be in charge of a company. But in those days, there was so many high-ranking officers and warrant officers left behind from the war that people of very high rank used to take a very meagre position, like company commander, which is normally a captain's job. We had a colonel there, and he had his wife with him, and they lived in the officers' quarters. And I think I understood that it was his wife who insisted that to stop venereal disease spreading, that we do the same as all the other units out in India in those days in the British Army. That was, they had an official brothel that used to be looked after by an NCO appointed by the commanding officer. And the local babu who supplied all the wants of everybody, including running the canteen, he used to get some girls together, and they were allotted a bungalow, and the corporal, that was the NCO in charge of these people, used to go there every day, and with the medical officer, and these girls were examined and pronounced fit, and so that any of the men who normally would have gone into the bazaar and one of the local brothels was allowed to take advantage of this amenity. It's rather unusual because when I was my long service in the army before, I'd never heard of it. Any official brothels being opened, it was always done underhand. Anyway, that's how things were.
You were going to tell me about the formation of your unit.
Oh, yes. The armoured car units in those days, when I first joined them, were composed of were called a company, and each company had four sections, and each section had four armoured cars, two motorbikes, and a 30 underweight lorry attached to it, plus the personnel. And the personnel were usually somewhere between 30 and 35 officers and men for each section. And each section, this was taken over from the old naval business of naming every ship and every equipment they had with a name of something which anybody could easily remember. Well, we had four sections in our company, and number one section was named the golden section, number two was the silver, and number three was, or something else, but number four I know was black. And each one of the armoured cars was given a denoting name. For instance, the car that I was in charge of, the armoured car commander, was called the Golden Eagle. And another one we had was the Golden Sovereign, and there was the Golden Orb. And the silver section had, well, some of their names was like Silver Ghost, Silver Cloud, and so on. So that everybody knew, more or less, without any numbers, where they belonged to and whose car was which and all that sort of thing. One thing I'd like to speak about is, while I was out in India anyway, is they used to have what's called a proclamation parade. Well, this was instituted after the Indian Mutiny, and was a sort of show of force of the British Army in India. And on the 1st of January every year, all the troops in each garrison at the parade in the morning, with all their regalia, and our unit, the armoured car unit, we used to parade all our armoured cars, all spick and span, and take part in these parades. And it was quite a spectacle, especially at Peshawar, because there was quite a big garrison there when I was there. Apart from our armoured car company, there was two batteries of artillery, two regiments of English infantry, and about four regiments of Indian troops, including a squadron of cavalry, and the transport people with their AT carts, and right down to the least common multiple of the British Army. And we used to have to parade, get ready about 6 o'clock in the morning, and get onto a large area which was allocated for this sort of thing, and parade according to seniority. For instance, the artillery, which used to be called the right of the line, always took the right position, and so they went on down the cavalry, and then the infantry, and then the transport. And that's quite an impressive sight to see these all on parade, all spick and span. And then about 9 or half past, the parade would be called to attention, and the general salute was ordered, and in the distance we could see an open brougham, that we used to call it. It was like a four-wheel carriage drawn by either four or six horses, and in there was the governor of the state and his wife, and these used to drive down through the ranks, same as the Queen's birthday parade, really, that sort of thing, and take the salute as he went by each unit. Then after all that was done, there was a dais erected where the governor and his wife and all the officials used to stand and take the salute as all the troops marched past, with the senior regiment going first, and we, with the, our armour cars, used to go by, parade by sections. That's four in a line, four cars in a line. As we got to the saluting base, we used to dip our guns. The Vickers guns were mounted in the turret, and as we got to the saluting base, we used to unlock the clip at the back of the gun so that we could dip the gun, the muzzle of the gun, down as a form of salute to the officials standing on the dais. Then after that, all the troops had gone by and dispersed to their various units and barracks. Everybody had a bit of a do. You'd go in the canteen or in the mess, whatever you belonged to, and drink gallons of beer and generally celebrate. But I remember in our unit, though, we had, as I mentioned before, we were quite a sporting crowd, the Tank Corps, or Royal Tank Corps as it then was afterwards. And what we used to do was after the proclamation parade, we'd all the people in the mess that I belonged to, and all the other people that we knew in the other units used to all go on a water wagon. We wouldn't touch any more beer or spirits until about June or July. We'd take part in all sorts of sports, and then, of course, there was the manoeuvres to do and all that sort of thing. So we really kept ourselves pretty fit. But when we got to June or July, people would look at one another in the mess, and somebody would say, well, I think it's about time we got in training for Christmas again. And, of course, that had started off. And from then on, we'd have 6 months of boozing, and then we'd have 6 months of restrictions and teetotalism. That seemed to go all right, but I often wonder where it was any good to us. However, during the time of the when we had these restrictions from January to June or July, there was a leave period organised for each unit, and each member of the unit was given the chance of having, you could have 2 or 3 weeks leave, what they call station leave. That meant that you could live in the barracks, but you weren't to do any parades, you were excused everything, and you were virtually on leave, and you could do what you like. So a lot of our bright lads used to organise a tiger shoot, and we used to get permission from the OC and get a 30 underweight lorry, and pay for some petrol from the pump to fill up the fill it up with petrol. And then we used to, 4 or 5 of them used to get together, and they had some of the officers had guns, and we used to borrow these and get some ammunition, get loads of food together and pack up in the lorry and take a couple of bearers with us to do all the chores, and we'd be off into the jungle for 2 or 3 weeks. And I only remember actually one night seeing anything or hearing anything of a tiger. But anyway, we used to have quite a bit of fun, and we'd virtually go native. We'd have nothing like any of our ordinary military dress on, and we'd just louch about in just a pair of shorts and an old shirt. And what happens in a tiger shoot is you get hold of a native round about the area where they, in the jungle, where the tigers are prevalent, and these natives get a lamb or a kid, a small goat, and tether it to a tree, large tree usually, and in the branch of this tree, the natives erect a bit of a staging. And what happens is you climb up this tree and get onto this staging, and you're supposed to stop there with your rifles and you want plenty of warm clothing because it gets very cold out there at the night time. And eventually, if you're lucky or unlucky, whichever the case may be, a tiger would come along and sense the animal tethered to the tree, and you'd have a chance of getting a shot at him. But I only ever remember seeing one, and I spent many lonely hours up in the tree and nothing happened at all. But anyway, that was one of the relaxations we used to get up to. Another thing was I used to go fishing quite a lot. I acquired a rod and some tackle from one of the old chaps who were an old soldier in the in our unit. And they used to call him Jack Fish because he was always, he's a proper authority on fishing. I used to get a gharry, that's a two-horsed cart driven by a native, and the horse, the driver used to sit in the front seat, and at the back, you sit at the back, very similar to the Irish carts that one sees in Ireland. And after you'd negotiated the payment for a journey, you'd tell him where you want to go, and he'd take you down, and he'd take me down to the river, perhaps up to about 15 miles away sometimes, and all on my own. And I'd take sandwiches and something to drink, and I stopped there all day fishing, and just watching the birds and the squirrels running up and down the trees, and also the freshwater turtles. I remember I nearly always lost the best part of my tackle with these turtles. They're huge things, and as you watch your line and you find you've got a bite, you tuck at the rod and you think, oh, you've got something big on there, and eventually when you pull it to the shore, you find you've got a turtle about 2 foot across, and he's got the hook in his mouth, and the only way you can get the get it freed is by chopping his head off. And we always used to carry one of these very similar to the Gurkha knife that they carried, and that's the only way I used to get my hooks off, is chop the heads off. But they're huge things, these turtles. Another thing I used to do was for relaxation, I acquired a camera when I was in Iraq, and because I was used to get all this money and didn't need to spend any, so I bought a Kodak camera and started taking pictures and learned how to develop them and print them myself, to get a what they call a printing out frame. And after taking the pictures, I developed them in a dark room and then put the films in the frame and face it to the sun with some printing out paper and developed the print. It's quite absorbing hobby, really. And everywhere I went, I used to take my camera slung over my shoulder and a cud stick. That's a long stick like a broom handle with a spike on the end. And everybody used to carry them out, nearly all the natives. And you sort of plod along and very much like a native does. And
were there any official restrictions upon photography?
Oh, no restrictions at all. Because in those days, you see, India was more or less like a colony, a dependency, all run by the British Army. And I've often wondered why, really. The establishment of the British Army in those days, if I remember, was 65,000. Well, if you remember that 65,000 troops spread over a continent, the guard, a population of 400 million, it gives you some idea of the extent that the country was in. But it was in such a state that British soldiers were looked up to as sort of gods, and all the natives were get out of your way if you were in a bazaar, and get off the pavement and let you go by, and bring their hand up to their forehead and say salam, sab, salam, and all that. So they were merely a more or less a subjective nation, I suppose. But we never had any trouble like that. Only apart from places like Amritsar, where there was quite a lot of riots, and every so now and again we were called out and had to go and with a magistrate and try and calm things down. But
when you went out to quell riots, did any shooting take place?
No, not by the time I went. I went several times, and what happens is that you take a magistrate with you on these riots, because if there's a riot occurs, the local magistrate, when he finds he can't deal with it with his local police, he calls in the military. So we used to go out in what is called in aid of the civil power, and you had a chit with you, a typewritten piece of paper, and on there it's says something about the magistrate and his name and the district request military assistance, and you have to get him to sign that before you take any action, because if anybody's killed or injured through your action, the authorities can sue you. But once you've got that sign, then you're in charge, and whatever you do, you're backed up by the British Army. I went out there several times, and we used to take perhaps only two armoured cars and a motorcycle, and perhaps a troop of Indian troops on a lorry, and once they, nearly all of the times I was out there, once they saw the troops and they were deployed in certain streets, they sort of calmed down, and after the magistrate had spoken to them and told them to disperse. But there were other times when the mobs started, they got infuriated with some of these leaders, nearly all Sikhs they were, and they'd get up and shout and bellow at the military units that were there and urge their followers to attack us and all that. But I never had any occasion to use force any time I was out there. But after I'd left, I found out there was an occasion in Amritsar where I think it was four of our armoured cars went out. It was a very big riot, and they sent as much force as they could gather. What happened was these, they got into the centre of Amritsar, and they found that there was barricades erected across the street, so they couldn't go any farther. And as the cars followed one another, it was all properly laid out drill, how many yards you were between each vehicle and all that. But as the last vehicle was past a certain point, so they erected another barricade behind and set fire to petrol and vehicles on either end, so the cars were trapped in the middle. And then they began throwing what now people call petrol bombs, but they were used that sort of thing in those days. And